So I know, I think at least a lot of the times I just don't make sense, and that's what that's what I do best.
Can you please open the podcast with just like, man, a lot of times I don't make sense.
You know what? For you, I will.
Welcome to Hometown Hollywood Podcast, where you can find advice, inspiration, and strategies for success from talented people that are making a name for themselves inside the film industry, but outside of the major film cities. Here's your host, Travis Myers.
I loved it. That was an inspiring read.
That's about as radio voice as I get. It doesn't have a lot of confidence behind it, but it's focused for like 20 seconds at a time.
Hello, my name is Travis Myers, and this is the Hometown Hollywood Podcast. Today's guest is Nick Pilecki, a cinematographer based out of Ontario, Canada. As he'll say in the interview, he's an open book, and that book is packed with awesome lighting, camera work, and practical tips for progressing your film career. Some of my favorite examples of Nick's work include his music video, First Prescription, Plain White Brigade, his SFA fireman ad, and his short film, Inhale. In this interview, we talk about Nick's crazy journey into the film world. You'll see why he has an eye for lighting and executes his camera work with surgical precision. And yes, those jokes are as corny as they come. Yep. We talk about cameras, lights, real actionable tips to meet other talented filmmakers, the best hamburger chain known to man, and how passion projects can take you to the next level of work. I really admire Nick, and I'm so grateful that he agreed to come on the show. I would recommend that you take notes on what he says, because I really believe if you do what he says, you will progress faster in the film industry wherever you are. So let's jump into the interview. All right, Nick. First thing I would like to cover is the confusion I have with your last name. On Facebook, it's Plicky. And so for the longest time in head, your name has been Nick Plicky. Is that how you say it?
Yeah. Okay. So it's Pilecki, like how it is on Instagram. But the reason my name on Facebook is has like all the vowels removed is because previous to being a DP, I was actually a doctor, an eye doctor. And I would have patients try to add me on Facebook. So I was like, I just have to remove all the vowels from my name so no one ever tries to contact me on Facebook. And I never changed it back. So that's why that's like that.
Wow. So I've heard a little bit about, I've watched another podcast or live stream that you were on. I watched a little bit. I wanted to be surprised by some of the answers, so I didn't watch all of it. But can you go a little bit more into the you were a whole doctor thing before you even picked up a camera? Because that shocked me. I almost fell out of my chair.
Yeah, I don't know. It's not that weird to me, I guess, because I lived it. But I went to university for 9 years to become an eye doctor, practiced for 2 years, and it was great. I love the job. Like, I love science. I love math. So that was like, you know, it was a fantastic career. But like every year during school, we would do these like skit nights, almost like SNL style things where like your year would make fun of the year above and below you. And me and my one friend, we'd write the whole like 45 minutes worth of sketches. And it was my favorite part of school. Like everyone else would be like, oh, I love going to clinic and I love doing this. And I'm like, I love writing the skits and just filming these stupid videos. Like, I love it. So I didn't think too much of it, but then graduated, practiced a couple years, and I started playing in a band, and we needed some music videos, contacted a production company, and they were like, oh, it'll be $4,000 for a music video. And being very naive to videos, I was like, I'm not paying $4,000 for a video. Like, we have like $200. So I looked on Kijiji, and I'm like, well, there's this camera here called the Canon T2i for like $300. Kijiji is like Craigslist in Canada. And So I picked up the Canon T2i for like $300 with the nifty 50 lens and turned it on. I fell in love. And since then, I've just been addicted to cameras. And this was a while ago, but just it started the path down to image making and filmmaking. And I kind of just took over my life.
That T2i kind of has that effect on people. That was my first camera, and I thought, man, this, I'm going to make Hollywood movies with this thing.
It's true, though. You look back on it, and you're like, it doesn't, like, it never looks as good as you thought it did the first time you saw it. But, like, every time, like, when I was in high school and we'd make videos, it was always with a camcorder. Like, camcorders always looked like camcorders, and movies always looked like movies. And then the DSLR was like, you look at the back of the monitor, and you're like, this is, to my eye, looks like a movie.
Yeah.
Like, the background's out of focus. It's 24 frames per second. Like, you were just like, this is close enough for me to convince myself that it's possible to do.
Yeah. It's an amazing feeling, and has got so many people into this, which can be a positive and negative thing, depending on how you look at it. But obviously, you're doing amazing things. I think I found you on the Anamorphic Shooters Facebook group. It seems like every time you post something on there, your stuff just blows up. And people are asking you how you did this. You post behind the scenes. And then when I joined the group, I think you may have been one of the first people I found. And I realized you were using the same camera I had. Like, there's no way. There's no way he's doing that with my camera. And so I had to ask you, and you were just the most generous, helpful person ever. Like, how does this kind of person exist? And you helped me through my little details and what I needed to get my anamorphic rig working. And I was like, I've got to meet or talk to this guy eventually, because people aren't usually this positive and helpful and wonderful. So,
yeah, I don't know if it's because, like, I was 28 when I picked up my first camera. So I never really felt the competition of film, or like to me, all this is just like bonus time. Like, I feel like I'm going to get kicked out of the industry any second. Like, I never should have been here. So I'm just like, I'm like, thanks for having me. That's my, like, I feel like a fraud every time I walk on set until I start lighting things. And I'm like, oh, okay, no, I definitely have a plan here, but like it's, yeah, I don't know. I've always had a very open mentality to it, because I think it's like, there was guys like Morgan Cooper and Patrick from The Wandering DP. Like, there were people before me that were like demystifying like how a higher quality, quote unquote, cinematic image gets made. And it's like, well, I'm not reinventing the wheel over here. So like, I'm not going to hold on to this information. If someone has a question, like, I'll show you how I did it. You can decide whether it's right or wrong, but here's how I did it, and maybe you'll glean something from it.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. I ended up shooting 3 short films last summer with that anamorphic rig, and shot basically the whole thing on one lens, or which is a terrible and wonderful thing to do. And then you realize, like, the day after you shoot, that the thing was kind of like misaligned.
Well, see, but there's great software for that, because I've definitely shot with a misaligned lens before, and if you go into Premiere under like the skew options, you can correct quite a bit. By the way, even when you're shooting legit anamorphics, a lot of times they're not aligned either.
Really?
Like, it's pretty crazy how often anamorphics have to get serviced to like be proper. Like, I've shot Kawa anamorphics, and I'm like, this thing is not aligned. It's like, you kind of just lean into the character of the lens. Like, that's why people love vintage glass, is because it's like, they say it naturally hazes, but, or like naturally has a bloom to it. It's old glass. Like, it's replicating what a ProMist does. Like, for a large portion of the lenses we love them for the defects. Like, if we're given a perfect lens, we look at it and we're like, this looks terrible. If you put it in like a barrel for 50 years, I'm sure you'd love it.
Is that what you call barrel distortion?
I think maybe. I think whenever we see a lens with something funky or distortion, like, it feels more like your own little lens. Like, no one else could have this little defect that you have. So it makes it more uniquely yours. And that's like, I don't know. It's just this, I think that's why people love anamorphic, because they see something and they're like, wow, like, no one else could be making this like this with the oval bokeh. And it's just like, Like, I feel like we're making something special here. Yeah. Whereas when you film something with your iPhone, you're like, anybody could do, everybody has an iPhone. Everyone has this lens. Like, this doesn't feel special to me because it's what anybody can do.
So I noticed a lot of your projects are anamorphic. Like, for me, I just like the way it looks better. Is that just kind of how you go about it? Like, do you push the anamorphic look on most things?
It depends on what the story is. But in general, yeah, in the past year and 2 years, I've definitely pushed the anamorphic, probably more than I should have. I feel like in the last 6 months-ish, I've split between spherical and anamorphic and try to make more like conscious decisions on like what makes more sense for the story, feasibility of the locations. Like, I think the big reason why I shoot anamorphic so much is because where I'm located, which is like 2 hours outside of Toronto, we don't have any big rental houses. So access to anamorphics is unbelievably low. Like, it might be me and one other guy in a city of 400,000 people that have access to an anamorphic. So with, let's say, 10 directors around the area pooling for DPs, if they want something that looks different, like, that lens has given me such an edge up to like just getting hired, because they know that that look doesn't come from anywhere else. Huh. So from even a business standpoint, anamorphic like helped me a ton, shoot from like one day a week to shooting like four times a week.
Oh, wow. That's a big jump.
Yeah. But like over the course of 2 years, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's like with anything, the more you practice it, I think you're better off shooting 4 days in a row than one day, like for a week over 4 weeks, because the like information compounds. And like, if you shoot 4 days back to back, you just have so much muscle memory and learning, like things become second nature. So I don't know, a lot of why I've gotten to where I've gotten to, which is not that far, but has been just right place, right time, ton of luck, and just being nice on set and communicating with people like how they would want to be talked to.
There's always this argument online on whether you should own or rent your own gear. And then a lot of people are like, oh, I would never own my own stuff. I'd only rent when possible. Do you think that's even a possibility for people who are trying to make it in places that are not, like you said, 2 hours away from the nearest rental house or further?
Yeah, like, it's such a, that one has always been a, like, a funny argument for me, because it's so situational dependent. Like, I think when someone says, should you own gear or not, they're talking about people who live in New York, who live in LA, or closer to me, who live in Toronto, who like have access to a larger rental house that would have, you know, a mini or like a mini LF or like a more expensive camera and a lens set. Like, if you're coming from a smaller area with no major rental house, if you want something that can even compete with the bigger budget commercials, you almost need to, or at least from my perspective, you need to own some gear. Because let's put it like this, I'm 2 hours outside of a major, like, major city that would have a large rental house. So if I want to shoot a commercial in my hometown, I have to rent the camera a day ahead. I have to use it for on the shoot day and then bring it back the day after. So while I have a good relationship with the rental house in Toronto, a lot of times it turns into a 3-day rental, and not many budgets can take on an extra $3,000 to $4,000 in rentals. Or at least if they are, they would rather be putting it into like marketing locations, bringing more crew out. Like, it's just, they don't want to see gear being rented and not used, like just sitting there on days. So in my situation, I found owning gear opens you up creatively, because what used to be a 1-day shoot with rental gear is now a 2-day shoot with your own gear. And if you're given an extra day, you're creatively just opening yourself up to trying new lighting setups you've never tried, or bringing out more crew to maybe have like a designated first AC if you've never been used to that. So now you can try new camera moves where you're like, I never could have pulled my own focus on this. So your answer is going to be different for everyone you have a conversation with. But for me, I think it's totally viable to own gear and make it in this industry. That being said, like, I don't own crazy expensive gear either. Like, I'm very much like what's something I can spend 10% the amount of money on, but get 80 to 90% the quality that, like, a lot of the directors and clients I shoot for aren't going to really notice. Like, if I'm shooting a commercial and they require an Alexa, we're getting an Alexa because the budget's less of an issue there. But if I'm shooting something that's, let's say, under 15 grand, where the client doesn't ask what the camera is, bringing an Ursa is fine for them. Yeah. Like, they're, if they see a matte box attached to the lens, they think they've hit the big times.
That's really good advice.
Yeah, so a lot of the gear I buy is, like, well-researched out as, like, I'm going to own this. I'll rent it out occasionally to local guys, or I'll do a small rental fee for productions. But I basically buy it knowing that, like, I'm going to learn this piece of gear, learn it well, so that when I'm on set, that becomes my asset to getting better and getting hired more.
I know that you have the Ursa Mini 4.6K. Or do you still have that one? Or, 'cause I saw you shot a couple with the G2. Or have you upgraded?
Yeah, I have a G2 now. Okay. But I'm going to be honest, they're very similar to me. I, like, if I pulled both files into Resolve, you can grade them to be basically identical.
Okay. I have the Ursa Mini 4.6K. I love the camera and I hate it at the same time, because I bought it and about a month later when I couldn't send it back anymore, they came out with the Ursa Mini Pro. I was like, oh my gosh, they have NDs.
Nice.
I'm stuck. And then nobody wanted this camera. And so I tried selling it on eBay, and I just got, like, fake buyers. Like, oh, I want to buy it for my my grandmother for her birthday. Can you send it to this address? Like, I'm not going to fall for that. The ones six that, times. So I still have it.
The ones that clearly aren't a PayPal. The ones that clearly aren't, like, a PayPal scam. They're like, you send me $1,000, and I'll send you back $800. And you're like, the math has gotten too complicated. I'm done here.
Exactly. So after 30 of those people, I've decided I'm just going to stick with this camera until it dies. And but when you're shooting with an Ursa Mini or the G2, do you feel a real difference when you're shooting with that versus the Alexa?
I mean, there's plenty of reasons to hate on Blackmagic, and there's plenty of reasons to love them. Like, have they had any issues? Yeah, I've had an Ursa die on me. Like, their quality control has much to be desired. They rectified it and got me a G2. So, like, I love them as a company. It's kind of like that price to performance argument. It's like, to me, the Ursa is the closest thing that could look like an Alexa under 10 grand. And there's not even competition. I've used an EVA, I've used a C200. They don't compare to me. Like, I can't get any of them to look as close as I can get the Ursa. And it's probably because I've had more time with it. But is an Alexa better? Yes, 100%. An Alexa out of the box is just like, you have to do less in the grade to get it where you want it to go. It's just a better camera. It's just, in my market, owning anywhere from a $30,000 to $50,000 camera rig would be me just throwing money away. Like, there aren't enough productions that I work on that would pay me $1,000 for the rental. So it'd be me bringing the camera out for free. And it would be a bad investment for me here. I think that's where the argument of, like owning gear comes in. And that's where I wouldn't own, like, super high-end gear where I'm located, because productions wouldn't appreciate it. Or if they did appreciate it, they still wouldn't rent it from you at a full rate.
Yeah.
But Alexa is better. Like, I shoot on it about 10% of my productions, and it's my favorite looking image, if that helps.
That means a lot.
Like,
especially from an optometrist.
Yeah.
You have an eye for it.
I have taken I feel like you've been sitting on that one.
I do have it in my notes, so.
I don't think I've taken any knowledge. People ask that. They're like, well, you worked with lenses over there. I'm like, yeah, but I'm going to be honest. Like, none of that information transferred over. Believe me, it was starting from scratch.
I would love to see you like going from lens to lens. Like, does this one look sharper or this one? Or does this one look sharper? That would make my day.
Just at the frop, you're being like, but what do you think of the bokeh? This one, it's cooler, right? Yeah, okay. So maybe we'll get you anamorphic lenses for your glasses. See the world in a more cinemascope view. Oh my God.
That would be the dream come true. Panavision. I actually heard somebody hating on Panavision anamorphics recently, now that I think about it. But
You're going to find people that hate on every piece of gear, and I think it's usually rooted either in jealousy or that piece of gear has screwed them over somewhere on a shoot. Like, if someone says that the Ursa looks the exact same as an Alexa, it's probably because you don't have access to an Alexa. But and if someone hates the Ursa, it's probably because like it didn't start on a shoot, and that's a reason to hate the camera. But like, if you get a working unit and their quality control has gotten better over the years, like it, you can do magic with that camera for like pennies on the dollar. Like, it's insane. Like, I still have my old 4.6K that I use. Like, I stripped it down to like no cage, bare bones, and it's now like my car rig and overhead rig camera because it's like as light as possible.
So when you said it crapped out on you and they gave you a G2, does that mean that if my camera for some reason breaks, then I can send it in and they'll be like, oh, well, I'm sorry for your loss. Here's a G2. Not that this would ever happen.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah. Yeah, don't ever quote me on that. You can try, but I'm not making any promises on what Blackmagic's gonna do for everyone that sends in a camera. But they were good when I dealt with them, and yeah, no, they're a great camera though. And there's a lot of great cameras out there though. Like, the new Komodo looks good. Like, I think people need to become less focused on like which camera is the best camera, and it's like, realistically, look at the things you're shooting or the things you want to shoot, and like, what is the camera that makes the most sense for that? Like, I will say the G2 image quality is the same to the 4.6K, but internal NDs, game changer as a workflow thing. Like, the amount of time wasted in like changing out filters and just making sure you have the right, like, how quickly you can do coverage with like a 2, 4, and 6 stop just in the camera, and they're already IRNDs, so you're not quite as worried about infrared pollution, which is a problem. It's just like
huge problem,
you know. So as much as people look at like test footage of cameras, like, you should really rent the camera once and be like, do the buttons make sense where they are? Do I do a lot of gimbal work and this camera sucks for gimbal work? It's like, do I love handheld and it's like, is the body too small? Because sometimes like I like a really heavy camera for handheld to like take out the jitters and add inertia and momentum. Yeah. If you gave me something like a GH5 and said, this looks as good as an Ursa, I'm like, well, I would have to figure out a way to rig this up to like just to feel right in my hands, let alone getting an external monitor, attaching something that records the codec I like. Like, there's so many things to consider with a camera that I think it's tough to say what something is the best. You can only look at like what's the best for you.
Right. So as much as I like talking about cameras, I really like talking about the work that you have done, because I'm a big fan of everything you put out. Like, your music video came out, the Basic White Brigade. I think that looked great.
Thanks. Yeah, I was very happy with that one. I mean, I obviously don't post all my work, but the stuff I post to Vimeo in general, I'm happy with.
Well, I'm happy with it also with you. I noticed you use the, just because it's my personal interest, the Forza 300 and 500. I just picked up the Forza 300 myself because it was on like a super sale. and I couldn't help myself. And now that I have it, I kind of wish that I would have just gone for it and got the 500, because it's not quite as bright as I was hoping it would be. Is there a huge difference in the Forza 300 and 500? Or would I also be disappointed? I mean, it looked super bright.
In my opinion, the 500 is definitely the one to go with. Like, the Forza 300 is closer to, like, an Aperture 300D with better color rendition, in my opinion. But it's closer to, like, it's a powerful light, but, like, you want to start to get that bigger Hollywood look. You want to start moving lamps outside of locations so they're going through windows. And, like, 300-watt LEDs are not quite powerful enough to, like, push through diffusion and to be believable as sun. Whereas, like, on an overcast day, the 500 coming through a window, to me, is where it's starting to be, like, believable. That's like, oh, this could be, like, a 1.2K HMI. Like, this is where, like, it starts to feel like larger production lights. So I'm excited to see that LEDs headed in that progression of where, like, it's starting to tackle HMI output. Because really, you watch any commercial that's a larger budget, and that's the fixtures they're using outside windows, because that's what looks the most natural.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm a fan of the 500. I don't own the 500. They gave it to us to try out on a couple of shoots. So that, full disclosure, that's why we use them on those shoots. But,
really? Manlight gave them to you to use?
Yeah, for a couple of months to try out on shoots, and I dug them. They were good. And yeah, I have really nothing bad to say about those lights. They got the, not even a big gear head, but they got like the power unit all in one unit. Cause my big beef with the 300D is that, like, it has like 8 different controllers you have to hook together every time you want to use it.
Yeah. That's one thing I really like, but no, is the thing that just clamps onto the stand. It's almost like it, I mean, the light on top of the stand is so light. It's almost like, there's your sandbag. You could just pick it up and walk around.
And the Fresnel for it's super well made. It's like the size of a dinner plate, which is more like properly how a Fresnel should be optically. So, like, it focuses really well. There's very little light leak. I don't know. It's a solid light.
Inhale. That's one I wanted to talk about. Inhale, the Cystic Fibrosis Passion Project. I want to let you know that you made me cry. That was so good.
Well, it was probably the director, unless you were super bummed out by the visuals, and then it was me.
No, but that was a really amazing little project. It was a passion project. Could you tell us more about just the process of making that film?
Sure. So that one was completely a passion project. We, bit of context and background. My son is a carrier for cystic fibrosis. So what that means is when he was born, he did the heel prick test, and they test you for all, like, kind of genetic diseases. And he tested positive for the CF gene. And they don't really know whether you have cystic fibrosis at that point or not. So they have to do something called a sweat test or a chlorine test, where they wrap the kid in blankets and make them sweat. And then they test the sweat to see how much chlorine's in it. So for the first 3 weeks of his life, me and my wife would just bawl every night. We just cry ourselves to sleep because we're looking at this little baby and we're like, oh, do you get to live past the age of 18 without a lung transplant? Like, and so we would do crazy stuff like lick his forehead and be like, does that taste salty to you?
Oh, man.
So we got the test, and it turns out he's just a carrier, which means he does not have the disease. So we were very fortunate in that respect. However, there was 4 families in the waiting room waiting for results that same day. And me and my wife were both just like, there's no way we all got the same news. Like, there's someone leaving here today that, like, had a child whose life is going to be shortened significantly. And that was, I don't know, when you start to have kids, like, seeing kids sick is, like, the most heartbreaking thing ever.
Oh, yeah.
It just doesn't even register with you. It's, like, it's the worst tragedy in the world. So in a very, very small way, the director and I wanted to put something together for Cystic Fibrosis to kind of not even give back. I just wanted to do something with filmmaking to help out Cystic Fibrosis, because there was nothing else I could do. So we wanted to make them a video. And so for 8 months, we followed this family around and kind of did their story. And it was a bunch of shoot days, skeleton crew, basically me, director, and producer, a swing on the days that we could, you know, bring a third person out. And it was super rewarding. And I think passion projects are a great way of like figuring out like what you like and like what workflow works for you. And it also sends a good message to the film community on like, yes, we do funded projects, but like, if I'm given the chance, like, I really like doing stuff like this.
Yeah. That's an incredible story. As you said, 8 months, and how many shoot days, or how often would you go, I guess, visit the family?
It was probably 12.
Okay.
It was probably 12 altogether, and it was done in like 3 to 4 hour chunks. These were not 14 hour days, because they're like real people. So I assume most people haven't seen it, but like there's a section where she went to the hospital to get some tests done. That's like a 2 hour visit. So we're there for like 2 hours, and it's just a lot of like coordinating. And also like they were the real rock stars of that project. Like we did our jobs and we were very fortunate to follow them around, but like to bring a film crew in even 12 times and play along with all of our silly film ideas, they should be given the credit of like they helped get this made more than anybody. Kaylee was a real person. Like that's, you know, cameras aside, you could have the best camera in the world, but like if you have great talent and a great story in front of you and someone willing to let you do whatever you want, you can basically shoot it on any camera and it's going to be compelling.
Well, I love that movie. I'm going to watch it again right after this, so I haven't cried in a while. So
now you have kids, so do you find that like you would come at it from a different perspective than, let's say, you would have 6 years ago, or when, however old you were when you didn't have kids?
I definitely, because when I watched it, I just thought of my own kids in her spot, and imagine my little girl taking the place of that little girl. I mean, I could see similarities. And I was like, I can't imagine a parent having to go through this. We've gone through some things with our son. He was quite a bit early. I'm actually forgetting how much. I think it was 2 months early when he was born.
That's pretty early.
So he was a little tiny baby, and he was in the NICU for 3 weeks when he was born, and that was tough.
I've never been through that. That sounds like the toughest thing, at, like bringing new life into this world and then basically having them be in the hospital for 3 weeks right from birth. Like, I couldn't even imagine.
It's rough, but it makes you, I mean, you definitely had your own experiences, and it makes you appreciate life and having life and having kids and appreciate moments with them. And I think you captured that in the film, like mother cherishing the time that she has with her daughter and doing everything she can for her. And I don't think you have to be a parent to feel that in that film. So I just love it. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And by the way, all of the projects that you're bringing up that you like are all shot on just the plain old 4.6K.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, like none of those are the G2 or anything. So I still love that camera. I actually think that the color science of the original Ursa, I might prefer to the G2 color science.
That's very interesting.
There's something about the way the skin saturates that I'm like, it just feels right. I love it. I think it looks great, and if it had internal NDs, it would be my go-to perfect camera.
I'm dreaming for the day that Blackmagic just says, you know what? All of you 4.6K owners that have just held out this long, ship them back to us. We're going to put internal NDs in there somehow. I know it'll never happen, and they'll probably just want me to buy the 12K.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold your breath on that one.
I can always dream, right? So I hear over and over that connections are one of your most important assets in finding work in the film industry. Do you have an active approach for networking, finding directors? Like, how have you done it in the past, and how do you continue to do it? Like, coming from a T2i owner to shooting projects occasionally on the Arri Alexa and making a living on it.
Yeah, kind of active / passive. Like, I never, I'll message directors every once in a while. You know what's great is Instagram is great for like disarming spammy looking messages. So like you could, like I've messaged my favorite filmmakers and just saying that I love their work. And like much similar to when people message me, it never comes across as like, I'm looking to get something from you. It's like, it's actually just a great communication tool of like letting people know like, hey, you're doing great work. And I just wanted to let you know that. So like I've definitely messaged directors before saying how much I admire their work, and it'll lead to like, hey, we should grab coffee sometime because you're within the area. And that's usually what I find is like, as soon as you can have coffee with somebody or set up a phone call with someone and they can hear your voice, they can kind of hear your rhythms, your take on things. I think that's when you start to learn, like, would I want to be on set with this person? Does this do we kind of like connect with a vision? Like, would set life be easier or harder with this person, basically? And it's different with everybody. Like the best director and the best DP might never work together because they just have such different takes on how a set should run. And like, if you have a coffee with someone, I think 100% you know, like, at least how you two are going to bounce off each other on set. So if you're talking about advice, honestly, have coffee with the people that you admire. And like, the filmmakers I messaged are super open. Like, you're like, hey, you want to get together like 2 weeks from Tuesday? And it's like, oh, I'm shooting that day, but how about Wednesday? And you just go actually meet them. Like, I've never sent a reel to anybody expecting that to come into work, because I know when people send me a reel, it's just such an impersonal thing. And it's like there's so many talented people out there that I watch it and I'm like, yeah, it's very good. Like, it's probably better than my work. So, but it's like a lot of times you're hiring talented people, but you're hiring people. And that's why like directors tend to hire like the same 3 to 4 DPs. It's because there's like this personal connection. So a big part of the film industry is like just not being a dick on set and like just being a good person. Like it's such an overlooked thing that people are like, oh, you make really good images, so that's why you get hired. And it's like, yeah. But I mean, there's also an efficiency thing on set. You never want to make the director look bad in front of production, client, agency. And like, they want to have a good time with you. Because a lot of these days, they'll go 2 hours overtime. There'll be multi-day shoots where you're sleeping in an Airbnb. And it's almost like you hire your friends. And when they ask for recommendations on first ACs, grips, PAs, like, I'm bringing out the people that I like to hang out with, because I'm like, I'm going to be spending 30 hours with this guy. So who are my friends?
Who can I stand for that long?
Yeah. That's... And I have to assume that happens at the higher levels as well. So that's something that I think is very overlooked, especially in a smaller community, is like just be a decent human being and you'll probably be okay in your film industry.
I would just love to see like Roger Deakins texting somebody, hey man, I'm gonna be shooting a feature, and he's got his Fave 5 on his phone, the Coen brothers, and you want to hang out, share a room with me?
I mean, Deakins is at a level where he's probably hiring the best of the best regardless of personal connections, but I don't know, he probably has a team of people he works with on every movie. Like, he's got his go-to, like, you know, camera crew. He's got his go-to lighting. Like, he just, you know, he's probably formed a connection with them. And that's, you know, that shorthand that you build over time. Like, once a director and you form a relationship and you have a couple of good projects under your belt, it's kind of like hiring a new employee if you were the boss. It's like every time you get a new employee, you kind of have to train them and like show them the ropes a bit on how your set works. So if you have a shorthand with a DP, that director is more likely to hire you again, because it's a lot of work for a director to find somebody new to explain, like, oh, this is kind of how I like to get coverage. You know, these are the ratios I tend to like on projects. This is kind of how it edits. So, like, you know, in general, I like to go wide to tight. Like, these are all things that seem small, but once you get on a set, if you have someone that you don't even have to have that conversation with, you're going to get the call again, or at least more easily get the call again.
So that brings me to, like, let's say I work on a certain level of project and there's only so much you can do at a certain level, and you find a director that does a level of work that's maybe several levels higher. How do you talk to them and say, hey, I got Starbucks for you if you let me DP your... Do you... Because I know that from what I've read from some of your stuff, like the SFA commercial, which was amazing. I heard you it's like, we went all out on that. And do you feel like you have to, like, sometimes just lose money on projects to just make something higher level to reach those higher level people and connections? Or does that, did that question even make any sense? Probably not.
Nope. What you're saying makes it absolute sense. I don't know if everyone has to lose money on projects. I definitely did, to prove that, like, because I'm in a smaller market and not a lot of the times, like, it's not the, or at least when we were starting out, it's not a lot of the coolest clients. It's a lot of, like, law firms, a lot of PSAs, a lot of educational, like, stuff that's budgeted, but it's not a Nike ad. It's not a car commercial. Like, it's not high fashion. So you're trying to ask yourself, like, okay, so I'm given this spot about an educational school. about an educational system. And you're like, what's the coolest way that I could frame this idea that's not like the typical voiceover B-roll, we can be in and out in 5 hours, because that's what would fit the budget. So you start asking yourself, well, I would need to do this. We're going to do a dialogue scene. Well, the dialogue scene itself is probably going to take 6 hours up, and we need to do a location scout to figure out that we're there at the right time of day, because we only have 3 LED lights to pull it off with. So it's not that it can't be done at a lower budget level. I think what just happens is you end up investing so much more unpaid time once you see, like, the seed of something that, like, oh, this can be great, and you just start investing your time and a little bit of money in to make that vision come to life. And I've done this like 10 times over, and it's mainly what's on my portfolio. And that those are usually the projects that a director, let's say from Toronto, LA, like all over North America, they'll be like, oh, I saw the firefighting spot. Can you come and shoot this thing for me? Like, they are the conversation starters that are like, I saw that. So, like, while you might lose money on one project, it also might be the thing that brings in like 3 to 4 months salary the next year, because it started a conversation with a director on their project. So, and if you talk to enough filmmakers, the stuff they're usually the most proud of is the stuff that, like, they've invested their own time and money into.
So I think what you're saying is it pays to put in the hard or extra work and making something look as good as you want it, because it'll pay off.
Yeah, I mean, or at least you swing for the fences and hope for that. I think if you always play to the budget you're given, your stuff's always going to feel smaller. Like basically, if you leave every set and you're like, well, that's all we can do with the money, then you're never going to level up. Like, your stuff's always going to look like $3,000 to $5,000, $5,000 to $10,000, $10,000 to $20,000. Like, it's when you can make stuff look like people only hire you once you've proven that you can already do it. it's a real catch 22 that, like, you've heard another podcast or like, how do you get a commercial or a car commercial? And they're like, well, you shoot a car commercial. And it's like, that's the worst advice I've ever heard. But really, like, but really, if you want to shoot something that looks like a $20,000 university ad, you take their $8,000 budget and you make it look like $20,000, so that when someone comes to you and they're like, we want to do something similar, you know the mechanics of like, okay, this is how many days it takes. This is how much crew it takes. These are the rental costs that are involved. This is what we need from you guys in terms of locations, access to facilities. Like, just the more shoots you do, the more knowledge you get on like, oh, this is how things get made. And this is like when you start out making films, like the quotes you send out to clients, or at least for me, are like so far off from what they should have been. And now you can like more accurately quote something. Like, you read their brief and what they want. You're like, it'll be this many days, this much. Like, you just get a better idea of like the workflow. And by doing more ambitious projects, you get more information on the workflow.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate that part, because I definitely guilty of just blindly throwing out a number and just hoping it sticks, and then thinking later, oh crap, I should have charged way more for what I just did, or oh crap, I should have charged way less. But yeah, that doesn't happen all that often.
But vice versa, it's not uncommon for like, if a project seems super, like if there's a lot of incentives to it, like you'll lower your rate for it. Like across the board, filmmakers are doing this. Like if you contact a director and they're like, yeah, so my day rate's like $3,000 a day. And then you get a great idea for a commercial and you have coffee with them. You're like, hey man, like I got like $1,500. Will you come out and help me with this? The worst they can say is no.
Yeah.
Like if you're honest about the budget and you're like, this is what I can give you, I love the concept, I love your vision, will you come help me out? And like, I'm starting to see that more, where like, as we start to wear multiple hats, like it's not uncommon for a DP to bring in a director to like level up, where it's like, well, this director has a name. If I hire them on my production, it'll show this director what I can do and possibly put me into a new circle.
So I guess now you have a consistent look with your work, and I really dig it, obviously, because I rave about your stuff all the time, and I reference back to your commercials and your music videos. Like, if someone asked me, like, I got asked to do a project the other day, and I reference back to your Fire Academy commercial, and it's like, this is what we want it to look like, right? And then like, oh yeah, that worked. But where do you go for inspiration, or where do you go about learning the craft? What's your inspiration now?
Inspiration now is less of like, early on, scouring Vimeo, finding out like what I liked, what I didn't like, trying to figure out like patterns, or at least like an interesting hack I learned early on was like, don't search DPs names, because DPs shoot a ton of garbage, myself included. But what you do is you search colorist names, like your favorite colorists, because colorists never get sent crappy projects, like, or at least they don't post them. So like, if you have a top tier colorist, if you want to find the best commercials in North America, you search that colorist name and you have like the same 10 people coloring the best spots going through. Like, if you really want to weed, because like searching things like Red or Ari, that doesn't work on like, they don't disclose the camera packages. But like, if you find a colorist at Company 3 and you search their name, you're like, oh wow, they've colored like all the best car commercials, all the best sports stuff. And like, you start to see like how other DPs are doing things, how they're doing things out of the box, like just interesting. Like, you're like, wow, I never would have thought to do that. So that was like an early on hack on like just seeing the variety of like what can be done in this medium. Nowadays, it's less about like I'll search up references for a specific project, but it's never like I'm scouring Vimeo. I'm not scouring Vimeo anymore just to like find cool stuff. Like it's a lot of like, I have two kids. So like if I'm not shooting, I'm probably with my family or doing meetings. Like it's a lot more like once you get to a certain point, it's like you're there's so much not shooting work of being a DP, like the amount of just like mood boards and email threads and meetings with agencies, production companies, like there's so much time spent on the phone during a day that there's less like scour Vimeo for the coolest things every time.
Wow. I really feel like you just, for people who are trying to grow from the bottom, the trick about finding the colorists is like the industry hack that no one talks about. That's one of those little secrets I'm going to put in my pocket. And you better believe I'm going to be looking for every colorist on Instagram.
It's a good one. And it also puts you in contact with, not puts you in contact, but like you start to figure out which companies are like the coloring houses that consistently get hired for the top stuff. So then you start searching for like, okay, so I obviously can't afford like the senior guy at company three. I don't have 10 to 20 grand to color my $5,000 video, but who are like the lowest junior colorists at company three that might need work on the weekend? And then you can send them stuff and be like, listen, I have $1,000 to color this project that I'm really proud of, because the key is you have to be proud of it. Just getting someone to color something is not going to get, like, you have to have a good product to begin with. And then you're like, I want that extra special sauce that I know I can't do myself. Where do I send it to have somebody like have second eyes on it?
Man, you're just dropping bombs. I love it. So that
also,
and coffee, like, I assume.
Yeah, and also don't take any advice from me, because you could totally fall flat on your face. I'm just saying what has incrementally, mildly worked for me. But everybody has their own path, so don't copy exactly what I do, because you'll probably just send me an angry message being like, none of that worked for me.
Nick, you've ruined me.
Yeah, I'll get the, instead of asking me how you build the anamorphic setup, it'll be like, yeah, so I tried having coffee and now I've lost my house, so thanks Nick.
Well, it's okay, I'm not much of a coffee person, but I might try hamburgers.
Hey, that's a good one.
Whataburger in particular, that's kind of a Texas thing. So if you're ever in Texas, then you're invited to have a Whataburger with me. I'll treat you. And your life will be changed.
Are you saying a water burger?
What a burger. I've actually growing up, I thought it was water burger. Cause that's how,
I thought you were saying water burger, and I'm like, okay, yeah, I've never had a water burger.
Yeah. It sounds pretty disgusting. a liquid burger. No. Whataburger, it'll change your life. Nick, I don't want to take too much more of your time, but I really enjoyed speaking with you about your work and your journey and how it has started. Yeah. And how it will continue to grow for sure. You just keep buying those coffees. And so I'm sure our listeners are going to want to know how to connect with you. What's the best way someone could connect with you or follow your work?
Instagram's probably the best, and it's just Nick Pilecki. I'm sure the name's spelt somewhere in the show notes or the title of this.
It'll be all over.
if you search that, it'll be on Instagram, and then Vimeo's linked to there. And I'm a pretty open book with everything. Like, there's no secrets or anything, so if you got a question, shoot me a DM, and I will definitely respond.
Alrighty. Well, if you are listening to this and you are a producer, director, or whatever, I would suggest you hire the heck out of this guy. Fly him all over the world. He's going to make your stuff look great. And Nick, I know that you do good work already. My goal in life is to have you shoot the biggest feature film ever made. I don't know why that's my responsibility. You're probably going to make it happen whether or not anyone hears this podcast. But
I feel like you should. I feel like you should make your goals more focused on you.
That's not how it works, Nick. But yeah, I'll try to do that too.
But it's been a pleasure talking with you, man. It's been fun.
Thank you for being on the show.
And that's it. Thank you for listening to the Hometown Hollywood podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please write a review and show some love. I hope this helps you do great work, be the artist you want to be, let you know that it's never too late to start, and that with some hard work, you can make some great things happen. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share and spread the word with your film friends. Leave a comment on ways that I can improve as a host, what you liked about the show, or any questions you would like me to ask future guests. Stay tuned for our next awesome guest on the Hometown Hollywood podcast.
An early 20s DP is like, what should I be doing with my life? And I'm like, man, just have a family. And a lot of your life, it kind of just sets out for you. It's about just watching options fall off the map for you.